You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm Joe Neal. In today's podcast, we're going to hear three stories by NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. The reason I'm picking these out for you is that Joe is the winner this year of the Victor Cohn Prize. That prize is given out for the best in medical science reporting over the past 5 years. The judges were given six of his best stories on medical science to listen to. Joe is definitely one of the best when it comes to turning a complex scientific concept into a story that most anyone can understand and enjoy. In this podcast, I'm going to present three of those six stories, and then in about a week, I'll post another three. In today's edition, Joe looks at the progress in genetic testing for disease by profiling a leading researcher. Next, he looks at the 50th anniversary of the polio vaccine, which happened a couple of years ago. And finally, he looks at the effort to eradicate a parasite that infects one out of every eight people on Earth. Here now, without interruption, are the stories in their original form, as presented on NPR's All Things Considered and Morning Edition.
Over the past few months, we've been talking with people about how much they want to know about their genetic makeup. In the latest installment of the series, we meet Nancy Wexler. Ms. Wexler is a scientist who studies a debilitating neurological disorder called Huntington's disease. 20 years ago, she helped identify the gene that causes Huntington's, an achievement that led to a genetic test for the disease. NPR's Joe Palca spoke with Ms. Wexler at her office on the Columbia University Medical School campus in New York City.
Huntington's disease has always hung over Nancy Wexler. Her mother's father had it. Her mother's three brothers had it. The disease typically comes on in middle age. As it progresses, patients suffer mood swings and difficulty thinking. Physically, they have trouble with movements and such basic functions as swallowing. For a time, Nancy Wexler believed the disease only affected men. But in the late 1960s, she learned that was wrong.
My mother was on jury duty when I was 21, and she was walking across, there's a big diagonal in downtown L.A., and so a policeman was watching her, you know, walk across at 8 a.m., and he pulled her over and accosted her and said, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself to be drunk so early in the morning?" And my mother was just horrified, you know, because first of all, she wasn't drinking. She doesn't drink. And, you know, her world just fell apart because she knew that that's one of the first signs of Huntington's.
And that sort of propelled you into the career path that you eventually went on, which was to study this disease.
Right. You want me to close the door?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
What about taking the...
Nancy Wexler's cluttered office at Columbia University Medical School overlooks the Hudson River. It's piled with papers, folders, research journals, and dozens of pictures documenting her field research in Venezuela. Wexler began working in Venezuela because Huntington's disease is unusually common in the villages along Lake Maracaibo.
I have to find a picture. We've got to see this picture.
Sort of nice. I like you've got this huge expanse of the Hudson River and the George Washington Bridge, but then the pictures sort of bring you right back down to Venezuela, it looks like. Mm-hmm. You were going to grab one. Which one were you going to show me?
Can you reach that one? Let me just see if I can find it.
Nancy Wexler is an intense person. Long, streaming gray hair and sparkly eyes, 58 years old. When we met at her office, she embraced me as an old friend, although we've only met professionally a few times. She finally finds the picture she's looking for. It shows a clean, freshly painted room. In the room, a nurse is feeding a woman in a wheelchair. The room was once part of a local bar. Now it's a clinic for Huntington's patients.
Everybody that works there, it comes from a Huntington's family. So if they can do whatever they do, that's why it's so clean. The people who clean, the people who are the cooks, everybody has Huntington's in their family. So they all have the first priority. Since the staff are all expecting to get Huntington's and they're caring for their parents in that same place, you know, they say it's very hard to walk in because every time I walk in, I think one of these days it's going to be me. And so they handle that by saying, "I want that bed. I want that room." No, you can't have that. I want to share with you.
Wexler says to find a gene, you need to find a family where the disease is rampant.
This picture, this family really helped us find the gene because There were 9 children, 7 out of the 9 children all got Huntington's disease. So really, this family found the Huntington's disease gene for us. And bingo, you know, it was like one day you don't have a gene, and the next half an hour you got the gene. So I love them.
The discovery of the gene was a scientific breakthrough, but it was also a personal turning point for Nancy Wexler. Soon there was a genetic test that she and her sister could take that could end the uncertainty about whether a debilitating disease lay in their future. Together with their father, they began to work out the logistics of taking the test.
How we would send the blood, who we would give the results to. And as we started to talk about it, my father said, "I don't know how I feel about this test. I'm really having a lot of misgivings." He said, "It's up to you, it's your life, it's your DNA. But for me, it would be tragic if either one or both of you is diagnosed with Huntington's disease, and we need to really think very carefully about what we're doing here." And his words really hit us like a thunderbolt, because certainly my sister and I have thought about Huntington's every day of our life, probably every moment since 21. So it's not like we hadn't been thinking about it. But there's a huge, huge mega difference between thinking about something, even when you think that you have thought it out inside out, backwards. There's nothing that anybody could tell you. You know everything. When you actually put yourself in the position of saying, "I am going to open that Pandora's box and find out if my life is over as I know it, as I want it to be." My sister is a writer. She said, "How can I sit in a typewriter and have a writer's block and think this is Huntington's, this is the beginning of the end? I can't do that. I can't manage that." And I started to think to myself, how would I, go to Venezuela? How would I see all those people? How would I know that that is going to be me? Not maybe me, but is me. How would I write? How would I be cheerful? And it's a very hard position, place to both put yourself in and keep yourself. And so then we said, well, why do we want this? What's on the plus side? What's driving us other than, certainly you're very curious. Of course, you're very curious. You want to know that you don't have it. All of my life since the age of 21 was completely pushing aside every single barrier I could find in order to develop the test. I mean, the research in Venezuela was all about finding the test. It was finding a marker so you could take the test, finding a gene so you could take it, absolutely treatment, of course. So test, test, test. I want to know. I want to find out. I want to be tested. Boom. Sliding into this huge, giant, concrete, gigantic wall of, what on earth are you thinking about, What are you doing here,
In the end, Wexler and her sister decided not to take the test. The reason, she says, is there's no effective treatment for Huntington's disease. Nothing she could do if the test showed she'd get the disease. But Wexler says there was one thing that would have changed her mind. Children.
Because my sister and I had both decided, the first thing, in fact, we said when we learned that we were at risk is we weren't going to have children unless we could guarantee that they wouldn't get sick. Hmm. And both of us were, wanted to have children. We had said no to children because of the Huntington's, but suddenly this other door was opening. Okay. And that seemed really the only driving force behind saying yes to being tested.
That never happened, so the next step never happened, so you never got tested.
So I never got tested.
And that's the status today?
Right.
I've gone back through the archives and looked, and every time this topic has come up, you've said, "Don't really want to talk about this private," and you've already emphasized that it's a very personal decision. What made you change your mind?
I think that there's an increasing push for people to be tested. And people are going to get pushed to get, you know, tested for all kinds of reasons. I guess part of what I would like to say is that people should not feel pressured to be tested, that you can't take back the information, that it can be massively damaging information. It can be illuminating, and it can be productive. You know, people use it that way. I've seen people use it that way. I'm saying try to know your own inner self as much as you possibly can, because that should be the guiding force, and not some outside job or outside boyfriend or father-in-law or doctor, really push a lot, or public, you know, impinging on you, because you're the one that has to live with that information, and nobody else does.
Nancy Wexler, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe. It was a pleasure.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. One of the most eagerly anticipated announcements in medical history occurred 50 years ago today. On April 12, 1955, the world learned that Jonas Salk's polio vaccine worked. The vaccine turned what was once a terrifying disease in this country into a memory. NPR's Joe Palca has the first of three reports on the science that created a successful vaccine and the people who did it.
If you were born after 1955, it's hard to appreciate just how scary polio was.
Here in Middletown, New York, a typical American town is caught in the fearful, silent grip of infantile paralysis. School closed because of polio. School closed.
Everybody was scared to death that their kid would get polio, so you took precautions. And we all grew up with the smell of Clorox everywhere.
Today, Beatrice Sharp Slutsky is 65 years old. She still lives in Pittsburgh, not far from where she grew up. Polio is caused by a virus. It spreads easily from person to person, although only a tiny fraction of people infected become paralyzed. Beatrice Sharp Slutsky was one of the unlucky ones.
My mother was doing laundry, and I was laying on a blanket in the backyard, and she said, can you go in and get me some more clothespins? And I went to go get up, but I could not get up.
Her father took her to Children's Hospital, where they diagnosed polio. She spent several weeks in isolation and then went to the D.T. Watson Home for Crippled Children for rehabilitation. By 1952, when Beatrice Sharp Slutsky came down with the disease, a war against polio was well underway. This was no government initiative. Instead, a private charity called the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis was paying for the fight. Today, that organization is known as the March of Dimes. Then, Basil O'Connor was its leader.
The forces of science and health carry on a perpetual offense in this struggle, for it is the war against disease.
One of O'Connor's warriors was a brash young scientist named Jonas Salk. Salk had worked on influenza vaccines and was ready to switch to polio. With O'Connor's support, he set up a lab at the University of Pittsburgh and began to work on a polio vaccine. A critical step in making a vaccine was finding a way to grow the polio virus in the lab. Salk needed help doing that, so he recruited Julius Jungner. Jungner was an expert in getting viruses to grow in flasks of cells.
So Jonas said, if you come here, I just would make one request, and that among the viruses that you work with polio, because that's who's funding us. And I said, that's no problem. That's not a problem at all.
Vaccines work by stimulating the immune system, getting it ready to fight off a specific invader, in this case polio. Jungner says Salk's plan was to make what's called a killed virus vaccine using virus produced by Jungner's cell cultures.
This was a decision that went against the dogma of the time.
Most scientists of the day were convinced that to get an adequate immune response, you needed what's called a live attenuated virus vaccine. This weakened virus doesn't cause disease, but it does keep copying itself after it's injected, so it's always stimulating the immune system. Salk's killed virus vaccine could only stimulate the immune system once. Jungner says O'Connor's National Foundation had created an advisory committee to decide which vaccines the foundation should spend its money on.
These people on this committee were older, more experienced, more prestigious than Jonas, and he had a tough fight. which I wasn't part of. I was in the lab, happy as a clam, working in the lab. He fought all these battles, and they were really intense battles that he fought.
In the end, Salk convinced O'Connor to support his vaccine. O'Connor wanted a vaccine as soon as possible, and Salk's was the closest to being ready. The first step was to try the vaccine in people who already had polio to see if it could boost their immune system. Salk got permission to test his vaccine on the patients at the D.T. Watson home. Beatrice Sharp-Slutsky remembers seeing Salk frequently at the home.
And one Sunday, my parents were down there visiting, and he said to them, do you mind if I use your daughter, Beatrice, in my experiments? And my parents said, no, go ahead, that's all right.
So in 1952, 13-year-old Beatrice got the new Salk vaccine. But it was scary taking a vaccine that had never been tried in humans. Maxine Fisher was also at the D.T. Watson home being treated for polio.
When Dr. Salk asked my parents, I told my parents to please say no, that I had had enough of polio. I thought it was very nice that he was doing this, but if anybody else wanted to be a guinea pig, fine, but I was too afraid.
Enough children did get the vaccine for Salk to see that it was boosting their immunity, and none of the children in the study got sick from the vaccine. The next step was to try it in healthy children.
My name's Maxine Heller. I'm 58 years old, and I participated in the field trials of the Salk vaccine in 1954. I was a third grader at Linden School.
Maxine Heller was one of more than 600,000 children to be vaccinated as part of a nationwide study of the new vaccine. Maxine Heller remembers Vaccination Day at Linden School was a media event, with Jonas Salk himself giving the injections.
And as we approached the tables, he just swabbed off our arms and eased in the needle. And of course, I was screaming my head off because I was terrified of shots, needles of any kind.
The vaccine trial was one of the largest ever undertaken. Vaccine expert Thomas Francis at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor took on the job of evaluating the results. It took him nearly a year to complete the analysis.
This is Tuesday, April 12th, 1955, a day which may well mark the most significant event in all of medical history.
This was the day Francis would officially announce the results of the vaccine study, although in fact leaks to the press had already indicated the vaccine worked. Still, it was an electric moment when Francis took the stage at Rackham Hall on the Michigan campus.
Vaccination was 80 to 90% effective against paralytic poliomyelitis. That it was 60 to 70% effective against type 1, and that 90% or more effective against the disease caused by type 2 and type 3 virus.
Not perfect protection, but good enough for celebration. It seemed the end of the scourge of polio was at hand. Then it was Salk's turn to speak.
If it were necessary to single out one person without whom all this would not have been possible, I would not have to think at all before mentioning the name of Basil O'Connor, president of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. It is of people like him that Emerson said many years ago, the reward of a thing well done is to have done it.
Salk went on to thank others who had helped him in his quest, but in his moment of triumph, Salk revealed a less charitable side of his personality. Many of his colleagues from Pittsburgh had come to Ann Arbor to share in the moment, including Julius Jungner, the man whose cell culture work had made Salk's vaccine possible.
I was sitting right there in the audience with my colleagues, the other scientists. We were sitting together. And then he gets up and he thanks everybody but the people who helped him get there. He mentions all the names. You know, I thanked the head of Chancellor of the University and Dean of the Medical School and the head of D.T. Watson Home and on, and the nurses who helped me and so forth. Nothing. And it was a feeling of tremendous betrayal. That's the only word I can use.
Jungner says Salk had become convinced that he was scientifically superior to his colleagues, insisting on praise for himself alone, even though others had played critical roles. Jungner left Salk's lab soon after the Michigan announcement, although he remained at the University of Pittsburgh. Today, at age 84, he's an emeritus professor there. He accepts Jonas Salk's place in history as the man who conquered polio, but he also knows there's more to the story. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Yeah. If you've never heard of hookworm, you're not alone. Today, the intestinal parasite is unknown in this country. But that was not always the case.
Hookworm in your body, your food don't do you no good. Hookworm in your body, your food don't do you no good.
When Blind Blake recorded that song in 1927, hookworm was everywhere in the American South and along the East Coast. Better sanitation, a better standard of living, has eradicated hookworm disease in this country, although dogs sometimes get infected. But worldwide, it's a different story. By some estimates, 740 million people, that's one in eight people on the planet, are infected. Hookworm rarely kills, but it causes a terrible burden of malnutrition and severe anemia, especially in children. A small band of scientists is working on a vaccine to relieve the suffering that hookworm causes. NPR's Joe Palca visited one of those scientists working in a remote part of Brazil.
The interior of the Minas Gerais state is gorgeous. Soaring black stone cliffs jut out from rolling hills. It's dry and dusty this time of year, but vegetation is lush. On small farms, you can see banana palms, coffee plants, and manioc. Cattle are plentiful. The people here are poor. Tucked among the hills are small clusters of one-room houses. Some are solid, made from adobe or dried mud, but others are just a rickety collection of logs with leaves and branches for roofs. Dogs, ducks, and chickens roam freely. Children in t-shirts and shorts scamper around, blowing whistles or chewing on sugarcane. One little boy is pushing a bike wheel with a forked stick. This is clearly a prized toy. These children are small for their age, and several have distended bellies, a sign of malnutrition. That's because there's a problem here. 70 to 80% of the people are infected with hookworm.
Most people don't know when they became infected, and that they are infected, and that they will be for their entire life.
Jeff Bethany is a tropical disease expert at George Washington University. He calls himself a foot soldier in the war on hookworm. Jeff's been working in Minas Gerais for more than a year. He's become a familiar figure, a swarthy man with an easygoing manner and a permanent 5 o'clock shadow. He speaks fluent Portuguese, although everyone makes fun of his accent. A group of curious children follow as he walks among the houses.
Quantos anos você tem?
10.
He's 10. E você? 7. E você? Quantos anos você tem?
8.
These kids don't look sick, but if you stood them next to American kids the same age, you'd see how small they were. Part of the reason is hookworm. You just can't avoid it here. The worm larvae live in the soil. They pass directly through the skin. Walk barefoot on contaminated soil, you're infected. Kneel down to pull a weed or plant a vegetable, you're infected. Once the larvae get in, they migrate to the intestines, where they clamp on with their sharp, jagged mouthparts and start sucking their victim's blood. Like internal leeches. As adults, the worms are about a half inch long. The more worms, the more severe the anemia and malnutrition. To make matters worse, the worms lay eggs. The eggs come out in the feces. There are no bathrooms in these rural areas, not even outhouses, so the eggs spread through the soil where they hatch into larvae, and the vicious cycle of infection continues. Hookworm is a chronic infection. In other words, you just live with it. And in a way, you don't know how sick you were until you get treated. Maria Jaraúj is 67 years old. She has 13 children and scores of grandchildren, all living in walking distance. A year ago, Maria took drugs that killed the worms.
Tell me how you felt before you had the treatment.
Eu sentia muito assim melhora, que eu sempre não aguentava assim andar.
My legs and arms were weak. I couldn't lift things or even walk up the hill. Now I can walk anywhere and I feel much stronger.
Children are even more vulnerable. The worm doesn't just stunt growth. The anemia and malnutrition dull the brain, making learning difficult. Schools are out on this day. It's the festival of Our Lady Aparecida, one of Brazil's patron saints. In the nearby village of Americaninas, people attend church services. And somewhat incongruously set off firecrackers from the steps of the Catholic Church in the main square. Giovanni Mas Silva is a 26-year-old schoolteacher in the area. Her students were given medication a year ago. She sees a noticeable difference in her classroom.
Pelo pouco que eu tô lá, esse ano eles estão bem melhor, entendeu? Estão entendendo mais
They're learning a lot more, they understand more what I explain, and they're doing better on tests. And they're a lot more active. They play soccer, they run around, and they really enjoy playing outside more. Before, they just sat around, not doing much of anything.
The drugs to treat hookworm are cheap, and they work. The trouble is, they don't protect people from getting reinfected. And in remote areas like this, people seldom, if ever, get treated. So Jeff Bethany believes what's needed is a vaccine to prevent infection. But first, he needs to know precisely how common hookworm is in this area. A year ago, he provided drugs to about 1,700 people living here, including Giovanni Massilva's students. In a month, he'll start testing them to see how many are reinfected. He knows quite a few will be. This is not easy work. Communities are not that far apart, but the roads connecting them are narrow, steep, and badly rutted. In the rainy season, they're treacherous. Communication is difficult. Just getting blood samples to a lab takes hours.
It's hard, it's time-consuming, and it uses a lot of material. So it took about 40 minutes driving through really tough terrain, and then we ended up walking 20 minutes to come to this small group of houses. But, you know, the value is that all of these people, this was an area where there was a lot of infection, and these are the people that really the vaccine is made for.
The job of making a vaccine belongs to Jeff's boss, Peter Hotez, a professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. If Jeff Bethany is the foot soldier in the war on hookworm, Hotez is the general. Ever since he was a schoolboy, Hotez has been fascinated by parasites. When he went for a combined MD-PhD degree, he decided to focus on hookworm because, basically, no one else was.
The problem is, let's remember who gets hookworm. It's the poorest of the poor. And so we're taught, although there's a huge market for a hookworm vaccine, the commercial market is zero.
A few years ago, Hotez convinced the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to back his plans for a vaccine. So far, the foundation has given $40 million to the project. Before that money came through, Hotez didn't know how he was going to pay for a vaccine.
We're even toying with the idea of developing a veterinary vaccine for dogs. With any profits that we could make, we would use to siphon off into what I really wanted to do, which was to make a human hookworm vaccine. Sadly, the market for veterinary products is far bigger than the market for products for human neglected diseases.
Now he has developed a human vaccine. Instead of collaborating with a pharmaceutical company, Hotez is working with the nonprofit Sabin Vaccine Institute. The vaccine is being tested now in healthy volunteers in America. If it proves safe, and things are looking good so far, Hotez will send the vaccine to Brazil, where it will be tested on people exposed to hookworm. Fighting hookworm is not glamorous, either in the field or in the laboratory. Researchers can get far more money and prestige by studying the killers of the developed world, like cancer or heart disease. Yet Hotez has assembled an international team of scientists to work on the vaccine. Several of them have personal experience with hookworm. Maria Elena Botazzi is the cell biologist on the vaccine team. She's from Honduras.
I remember when I was little and growing up, playing out in the fields and in the grass. And my father always used to complain to me, he's like, don't walk without shoes because you're going to get worms. So it's always very common for us.
Biochemist Gautam Gaud is in charge of making the proteins that make up the vaccine. He's from India.
I also suffered from these infections. Recently I went back and same conditions.
And molecular biologist Bin Zhang grew up in southern China.
There are a lot of people suffer from hookworm infection, and I saw a lot of people that cannot walk, they are very weak.
China and India may have a bigger problem with hookworm than Brazil, but the Brazilian government has promised to manufacture the vaccine if it's successful, so Hotez and his colleagues decided to work there first. Back in Brazil, Jeff Bethany is working long hours preparing for the upcoming vaccine study.
What do you think? I mean, just in your gut. Do you think you're going to have a vaccine in 10 years?
I haven't been in this business long enough to have those kind of gut feelings. I mean, of course, I hope. But it takes a lot of trial and error to make a good vaccine. It would be really amazing if we had one in 10 years. It would be really lucky. I mean, we have a lot of hope for this vaccine, but nobody goes and gets it the first time. We're learning a lot. We're learning how to make a vaccine, we're learning how to test this kind of vaccine, we're learning how to work in this kind of environment. And if it takes us 10 or 20 years, I think it's worth it.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's an incredibly beautiful place to live.
It's incredibly beautiful, and of course, the people are incredibly sick too. In such a beautiful place, there's a lot of misery.
A successful vaccine would not only relieve a lot of misery here, but the hundreds of millions of people around the world infected with hookworm. Joe Palca, NPR News.
That's it for now. As I mentioned earlier, I'll be posting the second part of this podcast in about a week. Meanwhile, if you want to hear more health stories, tune into your local NPR station. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.